finale.
The next presentation, the impact of coursability on lower extremity injuries, a systematic review of the literature. And our presenters today are Tara, Sarah, Leslie, Nicole, Sarah, and Sophia, and supervised by Mark Florian.
All right, thank you everyone for being here for our presentation. I'm just going to quickly reintroduce our group, point out people by name. This is Sophia, Sarah, Wes, Sarah, Nicole, and Tara. And our wonderful supervisor, Mark Deutsch, is up. So a brief outline of our presentation. We're going to go through the introduction, our methods and results, then our discussion, limitations and conclusions, and then discuss some clinical implications and recommendations for future research. So in recent or fairly recent years, the word core, the idea of training the core, has become very popular and commonly used in both rehabilitation and fitness domains. But in spite of its popularity, there is yet to be a universally accepted definition of core, of core stability, or agreement upon which muscles actually make up the core. One definition that we're going to present is by a man named Kibler, and we've decided to present this because it fits with our own operational definition for this review, which will be discussed later. But Kibler decided that core stability is the ability to control the position and motion of the trunk over the pelvis and leg to allow optimum production, transfer, and control of force and motion to integrate or terminal segments and integrated kinetic chain activities. So in other words, core stability helps provide a stable foundation through the trunk to allow optimal transfer forces to the extremities. Despite the lack of definition again, it has become somewhat recognized that core stability does result from the integration of three systems. As stated by Punjabi back in 1992, these three systems include passive musculoskeletal system, which involves discs, ligaments, vertebrae, other passive structures that in a neutral position don't provide much stability, but are there to provide stability of spinal segments towards ends of range of motion. There's the active musculoskeletal system, including tendons and muscles, which are able to produce forces to provide stability. And then there's also the neural and feedback systems, which works in integration with the other two systems by listening to feedback from receptors from the active and passive systems, and then initiating and producing desired outputs through the active system in order to provide stability. So there has been some previous research done looking at core muscle activation and core stability function in healthy and injured individuals. And it's the results of these studies that are commonly used as rationale for the use of core stability training for improving spinal stability and postural control, both of which are terms that are used interchangeably with core stability. A few examples of just a couple of these studies. Cresswell found that transversus abdominis, or TA, was the first muscle activated during expected loading or unexpected loading of the trunk, indicating that it is anticipatory in function. Hodges and Richardson, in two studies, found the same activation pattern, so TA was the first muscle activated prior to upper limb movement and prior to lower limb movement. Some other research has been done on patients with low back pain that's found that people with low back pain had altered trunk muscle activation patterns compared to healthy controls. So a combination of the results suggests that the anticipatory core muscle activation of TA that's involved in movement in healthy individuals is altered in injured individuals and therefore affects spinal or core stability. In addition, if you look back to the fact that TA is involved with or active prior to limb movement, it makes sense that it has been further suggested that in addition to providing spinal stability. Core stability training may enhance force transmission to the extremities and then therefore may play a role in lower extremity injury occurrence. And unfortunately, the role of core stability and force transmission to the extremities, and for our purpose in particular, the effect of core stability on extremity injuries and injury prevention has received little attention in the research. And so most of the literature on this topic actually comes from review articles, which tend to cite the same few authors in most of the articles in support of core stability training for injury prevention of the lower extremity injuries. Here are just a few examples, just keep them in mind. Nicole's gonna touch on the top two. These are review articles that have stated that core stability is effective in helping prevent lower extremity injuries, but Nicole's gonna talk about those later. So our final rationale for the systematic review is that there has, to the best of our knowledge, not been a systematic review conducted on this topic. And the question still remains, is core stability effective for reducing lower extremity injuries? Is there a more effective method of training? And considering the popularity of core, the common or how commonly it's used in training and rehabilitation and in fitness, these are questions that need to be answered. So the purpose of our review was to investigate the evidence looking at core stability measures that may predict lower extremity musculoskeletal injury risk, and to look at the effectiveness of core stability training as a means of lower extremity injury prevention. Now Sarah is going to talk to you about our methods.
Thank you, Tara. So we're gonna start here with our search and selection strategy. Just to mention, throughout the whole process of our review, we did have two independent reviewers, and a third party consensus meeting was used if any discrepancies came up. So we started here, checked five main databases, Medline, Embase, CINAHL, SportsDiscus, and PubMed. We also did a thorough search of Web of Science, did a gray literature search, and our last search was conducted in January 2009. Once we got down to the full text screen, we did do a hand search of all the reference lists of those articles as well. So with our study selection, we did the title screen first, abstract screen, went into the full text screen, which included using a standardized tool between the two reviewers, and it involved our inclusion and exclusion criteria, which are as follows. So number one, we required that they measured core stability or provided an intervention and had core stability training as part of that intervention. They also needed to examine the prevention, occurrence, or recurrence of musculoskeletal injuries in the lower extremity. Participants were required to have a minimum mean age of 18 years. They had to be generally healthy, and they could be trained or untrained. And the articles had to be written in English. Just to clarify, we wanted to give you guys an operational definition that we used for this review of what we consider core stability. And it's the ability of the specific core musculature to stabilize the spine and pelvis to facilitate force transmission through the extremities. Now, the specific core musculature that we're talking about, we classified into three subsystems. Number one, the inner spinal stabilizers, and they're responsible for controlling lumbar movements. The outer spinal stabilizers, and they're concerned with controlling trunk movements. And finally, the lumbopelvic extremity muscles, which can act either to maintain lumbopelvic stability on a fixed extremity or produce movement of the extremities on a stable trunk of pelvis. So just to show you guys this in a diagram, this is one that we used, and just to give you an example or two of which muscles we consider to follow in each of the subsystems. Now for exclusion criteria, we did not include any articles that were not experimental in design. And if they examined only prevention or occurrence of injuries pertaining to the back, we also did not include them. And there were a few articles that examined or included interventions that only measured or targeted subsystem 3. And as you can see here, that's just like if they considered hip abductors alone to be the core, we did not include them in our study. For quality assessment, we used two tools for study design. We use Sackett's level of evidence as described by the Oxford Center for Evidence Medicine. And we also use the Downs and Black tool, the checklist for measuring quality, to do our methodological quality assessment. I'm just going to pass it off to Wes now to discuss the methods of data extraction.
Okay, so for our data abstraction, a standardized data extraction tool was created, and the data extracted included study design and purpose, the operational definition of core and core stability, the characteristics of the participants, the methods of measuring core stability, the interventions of core stabilization, baseline and follow-up outcome measures, results and conclusions, and limitations and suggestions for future studies from the authors. For our data analysis, a meta-analysis was not able to be performed for two reasons. First was due to the study heterogeneity. So the studies, the included studies were heterogeneous regarding participants, interventions, outcome measures, methods of measuring core stability, and duration of follow-up. In addition, we were unable to calculate an effect size, and this was due to poor reporting of some of the studies. And in some of the studies that we could have possibly calculated an effect size, unfortunately, there was two interventions implemented, thereby creating not a true value of the effect size. So what we had to do was a qualitative analysis, which we used study results, Sackett's level of evidence, and grades of recommendation, which are really just a summary of the levels of evidence ratings from multiple studies addressing an intervention. So Sarah is going to go on and explain some of our results.
Okay, so the good stuff, what you're here for, right? The results of our search and selection process. So this flowchart illustrates the results of the search and selection process. Of the five electronic databases that we searched, a total of 880 citations were retrieved. Of these citations, 152 were suitable for abstract review, and of those, 18 were suitable for full text review. So then, as Sarah mentioned, we went ahead and took those full text reviews, articles, and searched their references to see if there was any other articles that were suitable. And there were 35, but after going through the process with those citations, only three of them were eligible for full text review. So in total, we reviewed 21 studies at the full text level and included six of those in this review. So the main reasons for exclusion, the first and by far most prevalent was review article. So it had absolutely no experimental component to it, and it was merely a review of other reviews. The second would be that it failed to measure core stability or provide a core stability intervention. Next, failed to examine injury prevention, and finally failed to investigate lower extremity injuries. And when we did search the gray literature and Web of Science, we didn't find anything of relevance. So as Sarah previously mentioned, there were two components of our quality assessment. This was the first, the Downs and Block tool. As you can see, there are five categories, and we scored each category individually and final score. Ranging from 14 to 20 out of 28, a mean of 16, and 95.8% agreement between reviewers, which is pretty darn good. So it should be noted, though, that we didn't actually use this tool in our qualitative analysis because the tool didn't account for differences in study design. So any study that didn't actually have an intervention automatically lost 8 points right away because we couldn't score that. So it wouldn't be accurate to use the total scores to compare or to say this study was awesome quality, Pete, or Leighton was poor quality. That would be an inaccurate statement. So instead we used it to look at the flaws or the strengths in each of the individual methods. So instead, we use Sackett's level of evidence to evaluate study design and to make recommendations. So as you can see, there was only one level 1B, the rest were level 2Bs. All of our studies were either prospective cohorts or randomized controlled trials, and according to Sackett's level, the highest level attainable for either of these studies is a 1B. But most of them got downgraded for various reasons, including length of follow-up was insufficient or not reported. The number of patients lost to follow-up was greater than 20% or not reported. And finally, some of the studies, the authors didn't account for major confounding factors, and this also took them down a level. So now I will pass it off to Sophia, who will discuss the second part of our results.
Thanks, Sarah. So I'll take more of a descriptive approach in reporting the results, given the high level of heterogeneity in the studies. And for presentation clarity, the studies are divided into two groups. The first group of the studies, as summarized in this table, they investigated if compromised core stability is a risk factor for lower extremity injuries in athletes. And for the second group of studies, they investigated the effectiveness of core stabilization interventions for firefighters and for athletes. So first of all, let's focus on those three prospective risk factor studies. So these studies compared core stability in injured athletes with uninjured athletes. The leading study reported that injured athletes demonstrated lower core stability measures, especially for hip abduction and external rotation strain. For one of the Zazalek studies, they used this apparatus with a cable attached to the trunk of the subject. And when the cable was suddenly released, they measured the trunk displacement of the subject. And the study found that injured athletes, they have a bigger trunk displacement indicating compromised core stability. For the second Zazalek study, they used the same subjects but a different apparatus. For this one, we have a motor to rotate the subject's lumbar spine away from neutral, and then the subject was asked to reposition him or herself back. And the difference between the end position and the starting position was measured. The study found that injured female athletes demonstrated a bigger repositioning arrow, indicating a decreased core stability. However, this was not presented in injured male athletes. When using core stability as a predictor for injuries, the Lincoln study suggested that hip external rotation strain is the sole significant predictor. However, the Zazalek studies suggested that a combination of factors related to the core, including trunk displacement, proprioception, and history of low back pain, predicted knee injuries in female athletes. However, for the male athletes, only the history of low back pain was a significant predictor. So in summary, these studies used different operational definitions and different methods of measuring the core, and overall, they provided level 2B evidence suggesting that compromised core stability is a risk factor for lower extremity injuries. And then let's focus on the second group of studies, the three intervention studies. So all of three studies used core exercises in combination with some other interventions. For the PEACH study, they implemented a multidisciplinary program with seminars emphasized on functional movements, proper body mechanics, core muscle recruitment, worksite analysis, as well as physical exercises such as bridging with shoulder or feet on the ball to strengthen the core. The COOSY study also used physical exercises such as crunches in addition to stretch and general fitness program. For the SHARE study, the intervention group had agility and trunk stabilization exercises such as stepping from side to side bridge, and single leg stand with windmill touch, while the control group only had stretching and hamstring resistance exercises. In terms of outcome measures, all three studies measured injury or re-injury rate. However, there was an absence of direct and specific measurement of the core. For example, the PEACH study also used a functional movement screen with movements correspond to firefighter activities to retrospectively investigate risk for injuries. And while the COOSY study, they also used the lumbar extremity flexibility and back strength as their outcome measures. For the SHARE study, they didn't measure the core. They only measured knee flexion strength and hopping and sprinting performance. So the results of the PEACH study revealed that core stabilization intervention significantly decreased back and upper extremity injuries, but not for lower extremity injuries. The COOSY study showed that there was no significant difference between the intervention control group for lower back and groin injury rate. The SHARE study showed that the intervention was superior to the control in preventing hamstring strain re-injury after return to sports. However, since this study did not measure the core, it's impossible to conclude that the results were due to improvement in core stability. In summary, again, the studies used different operational definitions, they implemented different interventions, and also there's an absence of specific measurement of the core. And overall, the studies provided inconclusive level 1b or 2b evidence suggesting the effectiveness of core stabilization interventions for preventing lower extremity injuries. And now Nicole will further discuss our findings.
Sophia? So as has been presented already through the systematic review, very few quality studies have been conducted that examine the relationship between core stability and lower extremity injuries. This systematic review has produced two main findings. One is that there is inconsistent evidence to support core stability as a risk factor for predicting lower extremity injuries. Second, there is inconclusive evidence to support core stabilizing training in prevention of lower extremity injuries. So those are our two findings. Despite the limited number of studies that have been conducted on this topic, many, many review articles have been written on this topic, as we suggested already, because it's obviously an increasingly popular topic. And we as a group also found when we were first starting to look into this topic that we had the general impression that we would find positive results for this area. But since there is a lack of scientific evidence available, the review articles are written highly based on theory. If the review states that theory is what is being presented in the article, then it's very clear to the reader. However, if they mix together current evidence and theory in the same article, it's very possible for the reader to misinterpret the information that's being presented. Tara alluded to this earlier in the presentation, and we're going to discuss this now further. Basically, we're going to go through a couple examples of how we believe the literature has been possibly misrepresented and then therefore can be misinterpreted by the reader. So for the first example, referencing of original studies is one way that we found that a possible misrepresentation could occur. So if you on the screen, there's a quote, and we took this from a recent 2007 review article, and it states, "Research from the rehabilitation literature has demonstrated the effectiveness of core stability exercises for reducing the likelihood of lower back and lower extremity injuries." So as we have just stated, we found that from our review that there is inconclusive evidence to support this finding. So we were curious and we wanted to look into this a little further. When we looked into the referencing for this quote, it was referenced by a few articles, and one we're going to go into particular just for time for today. So when we looked into the referencing for the study, one of the studies referenced for this quote did find that they reduced the incidence of lower extremity injuries. However, the intervention they used in that study was balanced and proprioceptive training. They didn't train or target train specifically at the core, and they didn't measure core stability or core strength in any way. So therefore, this study that's referenced for this quote, there's no real evidence to suggest that the balance exercises and the proprioceptive exercises that they did contributed to any form of increasing core stability, and therefore you can't really link core stability as causing the decrease in lower extremity injuries. So we found, the authors of this paper just found that a little bit misleading. Another example of possible source of misrepresentation relates to different views on what muscles constitute the core. We've kind of talked about this already, but there's lots of different views on what muscles look at core. An example of this is a quote that you'll find up there, and it was taken from a 2005 review article. And it states, "A recent prospective study suggests that deficiencies in core muscle capacity may increase the risk of lower extremity injuries." So we found the evidence on this topic very inconclusive, so there was a little bit. So we wanted to look into this a little bit more as well. And this quote was actually referenced from a study that was included in our systematic review, which is the Lee-Tan review. And a closer look at the Lee-Tan study reveals that what the study actually presented was that deficiencies in the external rotators of the hip were the predictors that they found for lower extremity injuries. So we, the authors of the systematic review, do not consider external rotators the core. It can be considered a component of the core when it's activated with spinal stabilizers, inner and outer, but as its own by itself.
we didn't consider to be the core. So we didn't include studies like that in our review. Therefore, the reference of this study to support core stability as a risk factor for lower extremity injuries, we find is a little bit misleading. These have been just a few examples of how misrepresentation of the evidence in the literature can suggest positive relationship between core and injuries, and why we might have got this impression ourselves. Now, having said that, the theoretical evidence to support core stability training for the prevention of injuries is strong. Current primary theories are a combination that we've taken from two theories we're going to present. Punjabi's three subsystem theory and the kinetic chain. Punjabi has stated, as Tara mentioned earlier, that the neural subsystem controls the active lumbopelvic musculature, which alters the compressive forces between the bony components in the lumbopelvic region. And this manages or controls the stability. The kinetic chain theory states that human movement occurs through a sequencing of body segments, starting from proximal and moving distal. Therefore, a proximal base of support could be considered necessary for the successful distribution of forces through lower extremities. Again, Tara introduced this earlier. Hodges and Richardson found that core muscle activity often precedes lower extremity movement. So your core turns on before you go to kick a ball or anything like that. They concluded from this that that contraction of the core can create a stable base for the use of movement through the lower extremities. Therefore, in theory, deficits of stability in the core may alter segments in the distal extremities and therefore put them at risk for injury. These initial core activation studies do support the theory of the kinetic chain, but we want to mention that they're quite experimental in design. And although the theory of the kinetic chain in combination with Punjabi subsystems is strong, it does not necessarily provide evidence for clinical application. Now I'm going to turn it over to Wes, who's going to talk about the limitations of our review.
So the limitations for our review, one of the primary limitations we found was that there was no universal definition of core or core stability, which made the literature search and development of inclusion and exclusion criteria very difficult for us. There was a limited number of studies available on the topic. A third thing was that we were unable to perform a meta-analysis. And finally, a fourth thing was that we only included studies written in English. Some clinical implications. Well, what we're hoping is that this review will be sort of a stimulus or an influence towards the development of a standardized and universal definition of core and core stability. So this will allow more comparable studies to be conducted, will provoke promote the development of a standardized assessment tool for core, and possibly facilitate the development of interventions that target components of this definition. So some recommendations we have for future research. What we'd like to see is a well-controlled, longitudinal, random control trial. And we hope that they would examine the effectiveness of core stability intervention in the prevention of lower extremity injuries. It would need to measure core stability both pre and post intervention. And it would be nice for it to have a comprehensive definition of core stability. In terms of the intervention, it would be nice if it could happen pre-season, if it would specify which subsystem is targeted, and if the intervention exercises would isolate specific muscles. It'd be nice if it had a lengthy follow-up of at least 6 months, and in terms of methodological quality, if it had a power analysis to ensure sufficient sample size, and it was well controlled to limit confounding factors. So that brings us to the end of our presentation. There's a few people I would like to thank. Mark Roche, for our supervisor, he helped us along the way and helped us in writing the document, thank you. And to Charlotte Beck, Darlene Reed, and Elizabeth Dean, thank you for everything. Questions?
Very much.
29 minutes, well done.
Good time to spare.
Yes, a question.
You guys talked about measuring core throughout the
pretty much the entire article. And that idea came in during your rationale at the beginning there when you talked about the Cresswell and the Hodges and Richardson article. How have these, if those are sort of the gold standard articles that you were using to build your rationale, and how did these researchers measure the core and specifically target transverse abdominis so that they could truly understand that it is an anticipatory muscle reaction when movements of trunk or leg occur?
Hodges and Richardson used fine wire electromyography and surface electrodes on the rectus spinae, but they use fine wire for TA, the obliques, rectus abdominis, and that's how they got their information.
Okay. And Cresswell, how did he measure core?
Because that one was a very interestingly confusing study. They use intramuscular electromyography too, so fine wire also, and some electrodes, and then they also measured intra-abdominal pressure. There have been new studies that are using real-time ultrasound, but that's how they've gotten their information.
So given the fact that clinically it's next to impossible to either find people who are willing to have fine wire electrodes put into their TA or actually have them perform anything while that's happening, one of your recommendations was to have a study where you measure the core pre and post. And is there a clinical way that you would suggest that might be doable?
Interesting enough, the latest orthopedic review, the vision reviews come out, and they've been looking at ways of measuring core, and they were sort of looking at EMG, and then there's also real-time ultrasound out now. Unfortunately, real-time ultrasound seems to be more in terms of activation, in terms of correlating to strength. So it's really, and it looks at muscle thickness, so what it does is by seeing thickening, it shows that's an indirect measure of activation, where EMG actually gives you activation and amplitude, and the amplitude is linearly will, in conditions where it's isometric contraction, or if it's a sort of a control lengthening, is actually correlated quite well with strength. So in terms of what we recommend, I'm not sure. There was nothing that we could find in the research right now.
I think the difficulty there is that surface EMG won't get to the true core.
Right.
It won't get to TA and Walton Fittis, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to test, which I think is probably one of the reasons why you had such a hard time finding good studies that truly looked at a real core, because external rotators are not that hard to test. Mm-hmm. But the true local stabilizers are not that hard.
Yeah.
I know you were just looking at lower extremity injuries, but did any studies that you read find an effect on back injuries with core stability training?
Yeah. There was a systematic review done on whether or not core stability was related to low back injuries, and they did find positive results. I don't have the reference for you, but give it to you.
Core stability was associated with back pain, or was it that core stability training reduced the incidence of injuries?
That it was, not that it reduced the incidence, that it was associated. So those who had, so there was no cause and effect relationship shown, because you really don't know if their TA or multifidus in this SysMap review was not firing because of their back injury, or it wasn't firing before their back injury, and that's why they got their back. So they didn't do a cause and effect, just that there was a relationship.
In the studies where you compared the injured athletes and the non-injured athletes, what were some of the common lower extremity injuries that these studies looked at?
So they mainly focused on knee injuries, especially for the SASMAC studies. They look at ligament injuries, meniscus injuries, and so on.
I was intrigued by those outcome measures that Sophia was mentioning about the
movement contraptions and like that. I was just wondering if there was any validity or specificity research that was done on those measures.
No, for the risk factor studies, especially for their special design apparatus, actually they also mentioned that it's one of the limitations of their study, since those are not in functional position. So in their study, they actually suggested to have a better measurement of the core. So yes, that is a very important point.
They also, to add to what Sophia said, they also, one of the limitations was that they either had the pelvis or the trunk fixed, so there was really no like lumbopelvic and extremity interaction. So it was very, very superficial.
Summer vacation?
I wanted to follow up on the question related to the association with back pain. And you've limited your systematic review to lower extremity, but could you not have also included upper extremity injury just as equally? And perhaps it would have cast the net wider and then maybe...
could have, and we did at one point look at it for curiosity's sake, mm-hmm. and found one thesis about swimmers. And that's it anyways, so we wanted to just focus on one lore, but yeah, we did look into it and we found one thesis on it, and that's it.
That's curious too. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, with severe shoulder problems that are quite incapacitating. You think that might have been looked at also. I want to get back to the apparatus. Was that in Suzuki's work?
Yeah.
Was that, they designed that and that has not been used by anybody else? Is it?
So for the one with the motor to rotate the lemur spine, mm-hmm. that one is what they designed. And for the other one, it was actually used by another. So for this one, they designed this one. And for the other one, it was also used by another study. They look at coercibility and back pain. So they kind of used that as a validated apparatus, but again, as Sarah mentioned, there are limitations yes. to this non-functional position.
I just wondered if it was just had been reported in the one study, or whether it's yes. even some of the ones that you may have eliminated, whether this apparatus was being established or being mm-hmm. used. I wanted to come back to your definition. Does it matter if you have a definition? I mean, given that this was a systematic review and you're looking at the review of the literature, what contribution is your definition?
I think that it matters in developing new studies. Mm-hmm. So if we want to be able to compare studies, they need to be testing or training the same muscles. So a lot of the things that we found, people were making these conclusions about core based on hamstring strength or hip abductor strength. Like those were some of the studies that we excluded, but they actually were making these conclusions that core stability prevented other injuries, but their core stability was hamstring strength alone. So I think that a definition is really important in order to make sure that all of the studies that follow are more standardized and more comparable.
That's fair enough. What's a lower extremity injury?
We didn't have to be very specific because there weren't very many studies, first of all. We would have wanted to exclude anything that was traumatic, like a fracture would be included. But we were looking at, there was hamstring strain, any knee ligament, meniscus injuries, ankle sprains,
basically just any muscular. So
excluding fractures.
Excluding fractures.
My question is related to that, actually, because one of the subs, I think your subsystem system 3 relates to the hip musculature as sort of being included in core. So, but a lot of other people argue that, you know, hip injury would be a lower extremity injury. Mm-hmm. Did you run into that? Like, that you actually have studies in which they had participants that it was a hip injury?
There was definitely groin.
Yeah. And if that was within this.
Yeah.
Within our systematic review, they looked at groin strain.
But you know what I mean? Because if you consider that subsystem 3B core, then that becomes a core injury. But no, it's a lower extremity.
Right. And that's what we kind of define, is that alone, subsystem 3 cannot be the core. Like if you just have
that, then that's not core. But in combination with the other two units, that it helps to stabilize the pelvis on the lower extremities, then it can be considered. We just want to be all-encompassing in our definition to make sure we included all the relevant studies.
Oh, I'm just wondering, as a clinician, should we be focusing our efforts on doing the abduction strengthening or the hamstring strengthening where there has been positive effect, or should we be trying to do some core stability exercises with our patients?
Well, the external hip rotators or the abductors are, we could conclude that Lee Tun says that if you strengthen them, it can reduce lower extremity injuries. So you can take that and say, this is what Lee Tun found. And even the presentation in front of us kind of touched on that area a little bit. But again, the research that we found from our systemic review wasn't conclusive enough to say anything other than that. If that helps.
Yeah, I think also, like referred to the presentation just before us, they also mentioned the importance of doing the clinical assessment. So if during the assessment we do find that the patient has a weakness in those muscles, so probably we should give them some exercises to strengthen the muscles.
So the two inner unit core muscles aren't torque-producing muscles, right? We've had a lot of discussion about strength testing and strengthening. I don't think they really have that much of a strength role, do they?
We've also discussed that it'd be, I don't think they do, really, but we've discussed that it'd be interesting to see a study done that looks at more of proprioception. So it'd be complicated, but to look at, compare strength to, and have an intervention for strengthening the core to sort of balance proprioception exercises, but having to make sure that you're also measuring while you're doing these exercises that the TA and all those inner unit muscles are actually on, to look at that, because I don't think they necessarily do have a huge strength component.
Because I think the theory that all of this is based on really focuses on activation, timing of activation, which I know you guys mentioned, which is really key, and the delay in activation in situations of pathology, it's been most researched with low back pain. And how that would carry over then into influence on lower extremity. But I think really what we end up looking at in terms of treatment clinically is activating the muscle, getting its timing pattern and its endurance back up, rather than its strength and its power, so that it has the ability to be on and creating that those compressive forces throughout whatever strength, power kind of activities the person's doing. Because if you look at all of the exercises that you projected, none of them are actually, they're not getting your inner unit in isolation. Those are all getting either your outer unit or the more global stabilizers like the hip muscles that you were just talking about.
And a lot of the time the exercises that we found too in other review articles and stuff were articles are exercises like that. So we also, I'm not sure if you said it here, but it's in our manuscript at least, that it would be interesting to see a study that was done based on like activation of the inner unit versus outer unit and see what they found, like the two comparison for injuries.
I think because of the difficulties in researching this area, one of the stumbling blocks that we're just still starting to overcome is, I think they've determined reasonably well how you can train people to activate muscle, activate the deep core muscles. But what you want to get to is that anticipatory function. So you want to know, does it actually contract before they move their arm or before they kick the ball or whatever? So you can't test that because it's too, unless you get your wire electrodes in the phone. You sort of make this leap of faith that if we train them to isolate it in a static or relatively static situation, can it then translate into this anticipatory function during useful ADLs or whatever? And there's a study by Sao just this year that looked at the fact that if you endurance train in isolation, it does make that leap to the anticipatory function, but it doesn't have anything to do with any extremity movement, or any extremity injury or stuff, anything, so I'm not surprised that you didn't come across it, but we're still kind of at that stage of the research.
Yeah.
just had a remaining question related to sort of the muscle considerations of the core. What role do you think the diaphragm and the pelvic floor muscles have in core stability?
They play a role in increasing intra-abdominal pressure, which then provides some stability. Other than that, I'm not sure.
That's probably theoretically an important consideration. Any remaining questions? Yeah.
Can I make a comment about that? Mm-hmm. So I, as Ted Richardson, have looked at the diaphragm and at pelvic floor. And Sean Gibbons, who's a Canadian physio, has also looked at the role of iliopsoas as a true core stabilizer. And you know, we know for sure that the pelvic floor does coactivate with TA, so it's often an effective training strategy for people. But that literature does exist to some degree.
Paul Hodges has done actually quite
a bit of work on that. Hodges and Richardson and
Joe.
Any
remaining questions?
Mark, this is your last crack.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well done to you all. I just want a big congratulations to everybody. Just your marvelous presenters, and the work was phenomenal. Now, a couple of wind-up things. One is that I know several of the groups are considering publication. Discuss this again with your supervisors, because this would be the time to do it. Systematic reviews can't be put on the back burner, and they really do need to be dealt with now. Charlotte Speck would like to have another chat with you, for those of you who will be going on to publication, because the level goes up. What's required for the course is one thing, and then there's another level for publication. So your supervisor and Charlotte will help guide you with that. So be sure to stay in touch, and everybody, share emails, because also there's issues around copyright release and forms that you will need to sign when that's done. So, and then my comments as part of the review will hopefully be useful to you in sort of doing the fine-tuning for submission. So, okay, so those are the first things. Charlotte wanted to be mentioned there. Yes, and don't forget the course evaluation. Things that I'm particularly interested in is the timing over the year and the support that you've had. I think I've been hearing some very positive things about that timing. I still need to put that forward to, the higher administration to know that that's still working for you, that the pacing is good, and particularly at the beginning, because that's when you're kind of, if we expect that there are going to be some flying turns when something doesn't show much and then have to go in another direction. So that would be terrific if you could comment on that. Please, your evaluations will be helpful, so please pass those forward for me, that will help me to do some cross-referencing. And are there any remaining questions? I just wanted to say that the systematic review is really that experience. We're not training you to be researchers, but what as self-directed learners, that this will be your greatest tool for your postgraduate education. Is your capacity to read the literature thoughtfully, critically, and be able to weigh the literature as transfer-centered practitioners, I might add. So you will do enormously well, so don't forget these skills, even though you may never do another systematic review. So thank you very much, you've done terrific.